Today on a special rambling about cars, Motor One editors are in the house to discuss the best new cars of 2022 so far. Can you believe we're over halfway through the year already? A lot has already happened in the auto industry. We need to take a moment, review what we've already seen. We've seen a lot, we've done a lot, and we've got the best crew in the business here to talk about it. So without further ado, it's podcast time. I'm Christopher Smith, and give it up across the way, Chris Bruce. We've got a full house today, man.
We sure do. Smith, you and I are basically playing Johnny Carson and Egg McMahon or Conan O'Brien and Andy Richter tonight. So we're going to let the rest of the folks do most of the talk. And real quick, I'll introduce them. We've got Clint Simone. We've got Brett T. Evans. We've got Brandon Turkus. And we've got Seth Miersma. And Seth, you wanted to start things out with a little bit of something to say. So with all, go for it, man.
Yeah, first of all, it's a call out, right? Because the idea for this podcast came from Jeff Perez, one of the Motor One editors, who's actually not here today, right? So he was like, hey, it'd be a great idea if we talked about the best cars so far, because he had seen similar things on other podcasts that we listened to, and we loved the idea, and then he bailed on vacation. Yeah, so I just want to say this was exciting for me because we've been doing a lot of work this summer on the Motor One Star Awards. So that is our year-end awards. That's where we take all the highest-rated cars that we've driven all year long, and we throw them together in one place. We drive them all, and we decide which are best in different categories. But it's a great time, as you guys pointed out, it's a great time to sort of take stock about what are sort of the coolest things that we've been in this year. So there really aren't strict rules around this. Like, you're going to hear about cars that maybe you can buy. You're going to hear about cars that maybe you can't. Like, we're all kind of gravitating towards stuff that we've actually been in, and we haven't all been in the same stuff. So it is not encyclopedic, but I do hope it will be fun and informative. And certainly we're going to have a lot of cool cars to talk about. So with that, I'm done. Well, I'm done for a minute.
I think it'll be very cool. It'll be very informative. I'm glad you mentioned the Star Awards because Motor One launched those last year to great success. And we're going to be doing that again. And I mean, Clint Simone, Brandon Turkus, Brett Evans, and Seth, I mean, obviously you guys, you're the ones that are going out to events. You're doing the driving. Bruce and I had to sit here and get to play talk show host. So, I mean, there's so much to talk about. We're going to try to run through this as quick as we can while being as fun and as informative as possible. Mr. Simone, do you want to start us off on this wild and wacky journey?
Wow, what an honor. So we're going,
it's not really that big of an honor, man.
We're talking,
it's Bruce and Smith. We're not really Johnny Carson.
There's so many heads, so many floating heads in this room. I feel honored. All right, cool. Yeah. So this is actually a thinker for me. You know, we are very lucky to get to drive a wide array of vehicles throughout the year, some of which we get to share with colleagues, some of which we get to go and do on our own. And everybody's opinion matters in all of this. And it's through everybody's collective efforts that we kind of sort out and rank what we like the most and what objectively is the best car in each segment. And I will start with my favorite thing that I've driven in probably over a year now, the Rivian R1T. It is a vehicle that is equal parts incredible and also frustrating in the sense that there was always one thing, just one thing to go wrong each and every day you got into it. Of course, you've heard these stories with Tesla products and other cars that are new to market. We use the term teething issues quite often in this industry, perhaps overuse it. And this truck is full of them. If you can get past those blunders, this is some of the most forward-thinking, incredible automotive engineering that I've seen since I've started this job.
Well, I mean, can you tell us a little bit about some of these teething issues? Because I know listeners, as much as we like to talk about the positives, they'll always want to hear the negatives. What are some of the things that that stick out to you here on that? Well, okay, they're a new manufacturer. We'll let this slide kind of side here.
I mean, Bruce and Smith, you both love old cars, and you remind me of that all the time. So with those old cars, when something just kind of goes wrong, you kind of have to hit the dash every now and then or do something to make it okay. The tonneau cover on the back of this brand new 2022 model year truck would never work. It's an automatic tonneau cover. I've actually spoken with a couple of different Rivian engineers and other owners, and they have the same issue. The weather stripping seems to get in the way of the sensor. So you have to physically go and kind of lift the plastic stripping that surrounds the bed to get the tonneau cover to close. That was a fun one. There were other little things. Sometimes the truck wouldn't react when you walked up to it with the key fob, and like smaller things that of course are not going to make the truck undrivable, but at the same time, you know, they're there to annoy you. My assumption is with hardware things like the tonneau cover, they'll keep having fixes for those as time goes on. And then obviously software things can be changed with over the air updates.
Okay.
So I got to ask, has anyone else on the show, has anyone else here driven the R1T? Have you experienced the same stuff, different little issues, or because I'm not sure, honestly.
I'm pretty sure that Clint was the first on the Motor One team to get into a Rivian product at all. I've been like in and around them simply because their local Rivian is has a production facility in Southeast Michigan. So they're about half an hour from my house or something like that. And just knowing a few friends and seeing them around, I've been in them, but never done a formal test drive, never any kind of shakedown. And then of course, our friends over at Inside EVs, our sister site dedicated to all of the electric stuff, have done some more extensive testing and reviewing. So folks that some of our listeners might recognize, like Tom Alagni, I think you just saw him on the screen on this video a little bit ago, have done range tests and stuff in them. So in the family, but I don't know. Wait, unless Brandon or Brett, you guys have been in the truck, and I just wasn't aware of it.
Nope. Have not had the pleasure yet.
Okay, I'm kind of hope, but not for me either.
Yeah, they're kind of specific to work with, you know, they're kind of specific to Los Angeles for the most part, and you have to go with them and see if they have a truck available. It was a couple extra steps in our normal process to get a truck for review, but sure enough, they gave us one for a week. We ran it all over Southern California and did this video that you're watching as we speak. And
in which you're wearing the exact same black t-shirt. I appreciate that.
A very different black t-shirt. Thank you very much. This is for one free leisure, a week, as we like to say.
Had to say it.
The wife uniform.
That's right. You keep it simple, black shirt. You look slimmer on camera. Did I say that out loud? That's how we do it.
So yeah, I know. My black shirts are all dirty right now. So, I mean, what are some of the positives then?
Yeah. Also, let's talk about how it drives as well. Let's promote a previous episode where we had Tom Bologna on, and he had at that point just driven an R1T, and he was the way this thing drove.
He was in love. He couldn't believe how well it was off road. Did you get a chance to experience that, Clint?
Yeah, off-road especially was fantastic. We didn't even give it the hardest test that we could have, to be honest, just based with time restrictions and availability. Sure. But on-road, if you're coming at this truck from any combustion truck, including a Raptor, including a TRX, it is still going to accelerate like something from Mars. It is nutty to have something that's this big, that weighs this much, with over 800 horsepower and power going to all four wheels with individual electric motors. The way it gets off the line just resets what you think is possible with a car that looks like that. It's honestly strange. We had the off-road, or I believe they call it the all-terrain tire package, which did negatively affect the handling, and that the tires would just break loose. They're obviously not made for high grip situations going around corners, but any of the more street worthy tire options would make it an even better handler. But it does things that a mid-size plus size truck shouldn't do.
Well, with all of that power though, how is that corralled off road? Because I know a lot of truck guys and ladies, when they're off road, it's not necessarily about getting to 60 in 3 seconds or whatever. You want nice controlled power. You want a nice thick power band so you can crawl over some of the obstacles that you need to get over.
The off-road mode changes the mapping quite a bit, and I believe it limits you to either 25 or 30 miles per hour, which I actually thought was too low in some situations. And when we, in this video, some pretty steep inclines where I had it pinned and it would max out at 25. It was calm and controlled going up the incline, but that off-road specific mode keeps the truck very tame. You're not in situations where you're going to be spinning tires.
Well, and this isn't obviously like Rivian specific, Clint, but I immediately think of the, you did a video, you were at the Easter Jeep Safari earlier in the year, right? And you drove, Jeep had an electric, a fully electric Wrangler prototype that I'm just blanking the name of.
Magneto.
Magneto. Yeah. Magneto 2.0, right? And I thought it was really interesting in that video that when you were talking to the folks at Jeep, they were saying, you know, electric powertrains are actually kind of perfect for off-roading when you're talking about rock crawling, right? Because you've got so much torque. You've got amazing torque and great control. Obviously, like, in sort of digitally precise control of that torque in many cases. So I do think that the, at least in theory, like the scope of an EV doing real off-roady things is huge, right? I think there's
absolutely. I mean, Rivian gave it an amazing first effort, to be honest with you, but we are in the earliest of days of EV off-roading, and that's going to really be, you know, transformational when that happens.
So I got to ask the fun question. I can see it wasn't on the truck that you tested here, but have you gotten to experience the slide out kitchen on the Rivian? Have you gotten to
cook some burgers
or something?
Yeah, we did ask for it. So I saw it years ago in prototype form at the Overland Expo. I almost called it Off-Road Expo. And they had just an initial one. It might have been functional, might not have. So I've seen it in person slid out and what it's capable of doing. But we did ask for one to test. I don't believe, but don't quote me on this, that they're going into production just yet.
Okay. It's a gimmick, but it's a fun gimmick. Like, it's cool. It's something you'd use, like, you know, probably a couple times a year, but it's so funny to have a truck and you pull up and you're like, oh, it's time to cook. And you just pull out this grill.
It's Bruce, you're in a college town. Like, Seth's in a college town. Yeah. Like, I can imagine, like, driving to the tailgate in one of those.
That's sure tailgating supreme right there.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Is it legal to fill the frunk full of ice and beer if the truck's not moving? It is, right? I mean,
I think it's legal to do it in Ohio. I'm
a legal expert, and I think that it's great.
As long as the beer's not open.
Yeah, truck's not on.
It's not within arm reach, and there's no way you could put it with arm reach. So, yeah, totally illegal.
Just don't fill it with ice and shrimp. That's my trigger.
For the 2.5 college kids that can afford one of these, this is your key to successful tailgating.
I think, honestly, though, what is the technical name? The central cargo tunnel or whatever in the R1T?
Gear tunnel.
The gear tunnel. Honestly, for me, it's like going back, I guess, a little bit to the preamble to this. I'm really excited about the Rivian in general because it's like it's a new platform, a new brand, a brand new vehicle, and to be totally honest, kind of a new technology, right? So things like that tunnel show what it's kind of the tip of the iceberg with the possibilities when you're suddenly all the hard points like an engine up front, like the same the kind of transmission that you've always had before, when those are removed, like the imagination of engineers can sort of run wild. And I think it's a great proof point for why Rivian is one of the more important companies that have come along in a while, and why this vehicle actually might be. I know we're saying that not all of these are the most important vehicles of the year. I actually kind of think, like, because these are getting in the hands of customers at a pace in 2022, I do think that this is one of the more significant, let's say, vehicles to kind of be delivered to a lot of customers this year for just that reason. People are starting to really have their eyes open to the possibilities of this kind of platform.
Yeah. It's really exciting to see where they will go from here. It is not perfect by any stretch of the imagination, but for a first crack at a new car from a new company, it's extremely exciting and very well-rounded.
Well, I mean, we have the R1S, and my Rivian knowledge is slipping me. Didn't we hear recently of another Rivian model in the works?
So Clint was driving the R1S, or the R1T. The R1S is the SUV,
right?
Which is, yeah.
And then there's going to be the R1X, I think. That's right. Like going to be the hardcore performance version.
And then the next generation. Yeah. Their next generation platform is, it'll be R2. And they haven't yet said formally what the form factor of that vehicle will be. But, you know.
Okay, listeners and crew, raise your hands if you immediately thought, please don't name it R2-D2.
Well, I think they'll have some lawyers looking
Rivian
at
R2-D2 with a horn that does the beeps like the Roadrunner back in the days.
Oh, I'm sure
you're
Disney
betraying
would be
yourself
all about that.
As a true nerd.
They would love that, yeah.
Rivian, call me up. I can be on your PR team for the R2-D2. Let me know.
So let's move on. Who feels really passionate about their choice? Who feels like favorite? Not only is it the best car they've driven this year, it's their favorite car just in general this year so far. Who wants to go
next?
Fine. No crickets. Takers. Brandon, you're up.
So it's funny that you pick me because you can't even buy my car and you will never be able to buy my car. I'm going to talk about the Mercedes-Benz EQXX.
That's a good choice.
Which is a concept car. I drove it in Germany a few weeks ago. Mr. Brett Evans has also ridden in it, so he has some experience with it. And the thing, this was not my favorite. I don't know if it was the best. It is certainly the most important because it shows a way of thinking about building EVs that is entirely different than just shove a bigger battery in it. You know, the battery in this car is about average size. It's about 100 kilowatt hours. It's not a huge battery by any stretch of the imagination, but Mercedes has been so obsessive about reducing the weight and improving the aerodynamics and being sustainable with it. And the entire goal was to make something that is super, super, super efficient. And I think as, you know, as EVs take off, as the price of lithium goes up, as things like, you know, things like that, you're going to see automakers take these more extreme measures to try and squeeze out extra electrons per charge. And it certainly didn't hurt that it looks very cool. The interior is fantastic and all sustainably sourced. And it was pretty damn good to drive too.
Well, I mean, so, you're bringing up,
How far did you get to drive it?
So we were only allowed to drive it within Mercedes proving grounds. And I'm going to pause to say it because it's a very entertaining city name to say, Immendingen. We only drove it at the Immendingen proving grounds. I had two stints. Each was about, I want to say 10 miles long thereabouts.
Okay.
So I only drove the thing about 20 miles. It really not a lot. I did not drive it at high speeds, but just driving around town or, you know, at around, I think my average was about 45 to 50 kilometers an hour. I was averaging 7.5. I got to pull up the measure now. It
kilometers
was,
let's see, per kilowatt 7. hours.
7.41 kilowatt hours per 100 kilometers, which is just hilariously efficient.
Yeah.
For reference, Mercedes took the same thing and took this car and drove it 1,200 kilometers and only got about 8.3 kilowatt hours per 100 kilometers. So, like, I drove this thing in a way that would have covered something like 1,400 kilometers on a single charge. That's just wild. And you don't really give up anything. I mean, sure, I wasn't driving really crazy. I wasn't driving super fast, but the interior is comfortable. The air conditioning works. I mean, it has a giant screen in it. It didn't feel that different from a production car.
And that's what I was about to say. It's not just a bare bones thing that somebody has thrown together. I mean, in a former life, I was around concept cars a lot. Most of them are not good to drive. I mean, they're designed to look great, to get people excited. The ones that are functional generally are functional because they need to be driven in and out of, you know, auto shows or various places. So, Brandon, I mean, you were starting off by saying, well, this is a car that nobody will drive. And that's true. It's a car that nobody will drive.
No one will buy. No one will buy.
No. Okay. That's even better. No one will buy.
But it was really designed. It was really designed as a rolling test bed. You know, right. Mercedes is taking this on two ultra long range road trips. And the first was covering 626 miles. The second was covering 747. And they're driving this in the real world. And yeah, it's got a lead and follow car to make sure that, you know, it's safe and people don't like run into it or something like that. But it was doing these journeys. And you really didn't give up much.
That was one of the things that I rode in it right after that first trip, the 626 mile one. And that was one of the things that they talked about was it did have these lead follow cars, but it wasn't super aggressively drafting against them. It was maintaining like a safe following distance, just like you would on the regular road. They were driving over a 13 mile.
They're like driving. They drove it over the Alps. Like, I mean,
yeah. I mean, it wasn't this like hyper efficient, you know, loop on a big oval that they could kind of control every single thing. There were people darting in and out of traffic, trying to take pictures of it. Like it was a real world test, and they were still able to achieve incredible efficiency out of this thing.
Right. I mean, I pulled up the story here that we wrote about. So the 747 miles run was from Stuttgart, Germany to the Silverstone Circuit in England. That was all on public roads with regular traffic on them. And so I wrote up this story. And what I thought was wild is at the end, they handed it over to a Formula E driver and let him do laps of Silverstone. The vehicle's max speed is 87 miles per hour, which is not race car speed, but it's plenty for the highway. And he did 11 laps around Silverstone and then finally ran out of charge in pit lane. So theoretically, they could have gone even farther if they had driven at, you know, normal highway speeds. Yeah.
Well, that was the thing when they did the drive from Cassis they ended that journey and they're like, we have another 140 kilometers of range left. Like they could have gone further. So they're really just scratching the surface of this, of building an EV this way. It's so slippery and it's so light. That thing weighs about 3,800 pounds, which doesn't sound like a lot, or does sound like a lot, but an EQS is like 5,500.
Yeah, that doesn't sound like a lot to me for an EV. Not at all.
Well, and the thing is, Brett, go ahead. No, I was going to say, you could attest to this. It doesn't feel like a concept. Like if they had told me, like, we are 6 months of putting this thing on sale, I would have believed them.
Completely. Yeah. And it's just like, they're taking a very holistic approach to this thing. It's not just aerodynamics. It's not just like a super efficient motors and stuff like that, but they also have, it's an air cooled battery. It's not liquid cooled. So that's kind of an unusual choice. Oh, and they decided to do that like because half the weight. Yeah, because they wanted to make sure that the battery itself was as efficient as possible. So you're not wasting energy lugging around a battery. So they've got air controls and air management to make sure that battery stays cool, even though it's not temperature controlled and water cooled. So they're really kind of just trying to make every aspect of this vehicle technology development as efficient and streamlined as possible.
And I really like the thought process behind it all. Seth, it's sort of what you were talking about with Rivian. Okay, now that we don't have to have space for an engine and a transmission tunnel and all this, now we can think outside the box. I think a lot of automakers aren't really thinking that far outside the box right now when it comes to electric vehicles. We've been designing vehicles in a certain way for over 100 years where, okay, you have to have room for an engine, you have to have room for a transmission somewhere, you have to have a cooling system, you have to have an exhaust system, you have to have all of these things factored into your design. And now you don't. And we're starting to see, I think Mercedes might be taking a little bit of a jump versus everybody else on this with some of their road cars that you can get right now, along with the EQXX.
Yeah, that's really one of my favorite things about it. Oh, go ahead, Seth. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, like, I think that if you're somebody who happens to be listening to this podcast, but you're not a regular listener or a regular reader or something like that, somebody who has not been following Mercedes news and product launch for a little while might be blown away by the fact that like the EQ line, the cars that you can go and buy right now, seemingly have like popped up from the ground fully formed in this like with crazy capacity and are really, really well realized. And then you've got something like this that comes sort of in sequence and is promising. Again, like everybody's saying, like this isn't a road car, but what it is it's a incredibly impressive, experiment that says like this is how far we can push this technology right now, and it's already they already have some of the best in the business that you can buy. So mm-hmm. I just think that the Mercedes effort in the EV space is about as fully realized as they could be in this period of time. And we all know, again, if you follow the industry, we know that they've been working on this stuff for a long time. It didn't just pop up in a couple of years, but the way that they brought it out, I thought was really smart. And the way that they're developing their technology and this and the brand around EQ, I think is also really smart. Just real quick, the only other thing I want to get your everybody's sort of take on this too, but when I read this story and started reading about the EQXX, I immediately had like, this is kind of the next generation of the, does everybody remember the Volkswagen XL1, I think?
Totally.
Sort of like
totally.
Super, yep. super hyper fuel efficient. I think it was actually hybrid, but
it was a plug-in hybrid, I want to say.
Yeah, plug-in hybrid, but it was a fuel economy play, and it was the same thing. I think they sold a very limited number of them to the public, but this the same idea, right? Where they're really saying like, hey, we believe in this technology. We believe in our engineering. We're going to push the envelope, and we're going to push the envelope in a real world way. And I just find that fascinating. Like, really to lay your cards on the table like that is interesting. And I think brings a lot of credibility to the brand, or in this case, the sub brand. So that's it.
No, totally. I think that's a very fair point. I think I definitely see those similarities as well. Unfortunately, this isn't going to go into production, but what Mercedes has learned from this vehicle, we are certainly going to see in EQ vehicles going down the line.
And I think we're already seeing a lot of what they've learned in the products that are out there now.
Well, actually, no, that's the interesting thing. They only put pen to paper on this about 18 months ago.
When
you think about it like that, like there's an entire portion of this that like, I didn't have room to tell this part of the story. Like it was 18 months ago, and they basically took a Mercedes GLB and dropped all of the EQXX internals under this GLB, and they did all the testing in that, and then they fed all that data back and did all this real world modeling based on the data, and it was absolutely wild. And it just for reasons it ended up on the cutting room floor of my story. But you know, this we haven't even seen the fruits of what this car is producing. Like it's nuts. It is absolutely crazy what the next 10 years are going to be like. It's, you know, I love to see the Rivians. I love to see the Teslas and the Lucids. All of those are great. I'm a sucker for the legacy automakers, and this is such an exciting car because it shows just what these brands that have been around for decades are capable of.
I have one real world question for Brandon and Brett, who have actually been in this thing and seen it. Because one thing I can't really get my head around is the scale of this thing, because of like the boat tail and like the shape, it looks like it should be 40 feet long in real life. What is it actually like? What is the size?
It's smaller than an S-Class.
It's only about as long as a C-Class.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
The interior is like A-Class size. It's not a big interior.
It's definitely pretty compact, but yeah, you don't get that with the big wheels and the long boat tail. It looks huge, but it's actually only about as big as a C-Class in terms of bumper to bumper length. So, okay. They're actually kind of saying that some of those styling features and stuff like that, you probably will start seeing on, I think A-Class is the next one to get a big redesign. And that's actually going to be an EV first product rather than a gas vehicle that's converted to an EV. So you'll probably start to see some of these, you know, maybe the air-cooled battery, maybe the unique battery chemistry, those might start showing up in the next five or 10 years in the A-Class.
Very cool. No, there's a lot going on with Mercedes. This is a good little moment to take a pause and say, if you want to catch up on all of the news for Mercedes and every single automaker in freaking existence, go to MotorOne.com, where you can read all of our stories. Of course, you want to follow Rambling About Cars on YouTube, on our YouTube channel, Motor One Podcast. We're on every streaming platform and more that probably we don't know about. And we always love to get your emails. You can email us podcast@MotorOne.com. Comment on our YouTube video. Comment on our summary article that goes up at MotorOne.com. Every Friday, there are two people left that need to talk about some of the best cars they've driven so far.
I just want to add one thing. What? If you've left a comment on YouTube in the last 2 weeks, I have commented on all of them today. So your comment has been answered.
Not only that, I've been commenting too. What?
Have you?
I have. I've been trying to take a little bit of time. So, yes, definitely we read your comments. We try to respond when we can. We love the audience feedback. We love hearing back from our ramblers. Oh, totally. You are ramblers out there. So we need to keep talking about cars. We've got a lot more to go here. I'm going to toss over to Brett. What do you think, Brett? Are you ready to go?
Absolutely. I'm gonna be doing the exact opposite of what Clint and Brandon are talking about, because my car has been on sale for in one form or another since 2016, and it actually has the old engine. It's the Porsche Boxster, Porsche 718 Boxster 25 years edition. Porsche kind of modernized the Boxster a couple years back and gave it turbocharged engines. This one goes back to the naturally aspirated flat six, the 4-liter flat six. It's got a 6-speed manual. It doesn't have any sophisticated powertrain technology to speak of, but it is just one absolute hell of a machine. I just like, this was one of those cars that when they dropped it off in my driveway, I stared at it for about 20 minutes and then I didn't stop driving it until it was time to give it back. It was just, I could not, every opportunity I had, I was eating out every meal. Everything I did was just revolved around taking this car out for a drive. So just an incredible, stunning machine in every single way.
I'd also like to put it out there that I dropped that in your driveway and had just come from across the other side of Los Angeles bitching about it because I had just spent 2 hours in traffic, which reminds me that I don't care what anybody has to say. I will never, ever, ever drive a manual car as a daily. That is a
this is the smallest sweetest violin in the world.
I love that car with all my heart too, and I was ready to drive it to a CarMax and drop the keys in it on the way to your house. A car that is not even
so
mine.
So, if you want Clint's personal email address, if you want to drop any hate,
pull the plug.
It was divine. It was just like, so agreed, it was a manual transmission. If you are a baby like Clint, it does get annoying in traffic. But
it's true. He's right.
Some in every other situation, it's incredible. I mean, it's just like so much fun to drive. I did a video on it with our video producer, and both of us were just like dying the entire time. The best part about it, though, beyond the incredible performance, is just how it looks. I mean, they really threw every Porsche design cue at this thing that they could. And it's designed to mimic the original Boxster concept from 1993. So that's why it has the silver paint with those gold wheels. And then some cool details like a black wraparound. Black wraparound windshield surround. It's got a red top.
Is that
a
928 or a 968 shirt while I interrupt you real quick?
928. Yeah. It's okay. A 928. Gotcha.
That red top is just like my heart is on fire for that. I love it so much.
Matching interior too.
A silver Porsche with a red interior is just like my idea of perfection, automotive perfection. Anyways.
Didn't you once have a silver Porsche with a red interior, Seth?
Black
interior. Sadly, no. I had a black. A 986 Boxster with a black interior, which I loved and still am very sad that I sold. But this car is amazing. Honestly, like. When we were going back and forth about this episode, I know Clint and I were both talking about we've both been in this year like 911 GTSs of different. I think Clint, you had the convertible, and I had the coupe. Brandon has driven every 911 of this generation, I think, at this point, basically. But this there's always something about the Boxster since the first one that just like tugs on my heartstrings. Like I'm a sucker for the smaller, lighter, underpowered thing, and I know this is far from underpowered, but. Versus the kind of range topper. And I think Porsche really nailed it in terms of it's kind of fan service, but it's also just like a great car too. And they're drawing really, really heavily on a lot of different elements of their legacy for this car. So I just think it really comes together in a beautiful way. And I'm incredibly jealous because I know this is a car that I will never, ever drive and would love to. So
I also just learned that you can fit in a Boxster. That's exciting. I had no idea.
Even the Gen 1, it's tight.
I thought it was a non-starter.
The roof was always down, right?
So no, I could drive with the roof up. That was really the test. But it was claustrophobic. Let's put it that way.
So my favorite thing about this 718 that Brett drove is that the best thing about it, you can get on every other 718, and that's the 4-liter flat six, which is just an absolute peach of an engine. I mean, I'm in the minority in that I like the 4-cylinder Boxster. I think it's got character, even if it doesn't sound great. But this engine is just like a chef's kiss kind of thing. Like it is just perfect.
Like the sound alone is enough of a selling point. I don't care how nice the 4-cylinder revs. I don't care anything about the 4-cylinder's performance. If it doesn't sound like this 4-liter flat six, I am not interested. It was just like, it was incredible. It was so good. Everything about it.
And what I like about it also, too, Brett, is that it's because it's a Boxster, not a 911. It's very affordable, right?
Oh yeah, exactly. Only $120,000 if you can get your hands on one. This was the most frustrating thing about this car was I have it's a pretty Z4 limited, right yeah. now. I have a Z4 right now that I love, and I've always loved that car ever since I bought it. And everyone's always kind of teased me that, like, oh, you're just driving this car until you can afford a Porsche. And I was like, no, not at all. And then I drove this one, and I was like, no, yeah, I'm driving the Z4 until I can afford a Porsche. Like, it just, yeah. it ruined me. It completely ruined me for every other car that I've driven so far.
So what really stands out here besides that you can't get on like a Boxster 4.0 or GTS 4.0? I mean, is it purely aesthetic that we're talking about, or is there anything you can't order?
Yeah, in fact, they limit you a little bit. I don't think you can get the ceramic brakes on the 25 years edition. I don't think you can get the bucket seats on the 25 years. So they really want.
What about exclusive to the 25 years? It's really the wheels and like
yeah, it's just and cosmetics. Yeah,
I think color. So there combo you go. Buy a
GTS
well.
GTS Boxster.
Here's those the thing though, Brandon. Really the only pretty, reason though. That doesn't work for me is I don't really like all the gloss black that you get on the GTS. This was just like perfect pure Porsche. There's no modern trendiness about it. It just is classic design done perfectly.
Brett also wants to be that guy that takes his Boxster to a Cars and Coffee, then lectures people about how it matches the original concept.
He'll bring a plaque with him.
Porsche bought it. He's sipping coffee as he's telling the story.
Wait, Clint, I couldn't hear you over you complaining about driving stick in a
yeah, cross crown.
What were you saying
too.
There?
Yeah, exactly.
Anyway, it was great. I loved it. At $120,000, it was the second cheapest vehicle we'll talk about today. But it was still absolutely, absolutely, absolutely wonderful. Great, great car.
Yeah, for Smith and I, who don't get test cars, all of these cars are basically our house that we've tested, that we've discussed so far, except the Rivian. But otherwise, yeah.
Well, but the Rivian has a kitchen, right? Costs.
The Rivian does have a kitchen, yeah, so I could live in it.
That it's is a good point.
Well, I think it's time to toss this over to Seth. I know you have some quality picks. Go ahead and lay it on us, man.
So, I mean, one thing is interesting is, and I'm glad that we talked about the Boxster in the middle because we've gotten a lot of EVs here, and I don't want the listeners to think that we've gone again like to just the soft plug. Like, we do have a sister site that we all love very much called Inside EVs, where we talk about nothing but electric vehicles. They have a great podcast. They do stuff too. It just so happens, I think, that this year we've all been in so many electric cars, and they've all, in many cases, are so shockingly great. Like we're not expecting them, or they're like, in the case of the Rivian or the Polestar that I want to talk about, like really brand new to the market, so they're really fascinating, right? So I think it's a sign of the times, right? Yeah,
I haven't driven a gas powered car in over a month at this point.
I know Clint's probably close to being there with you too. I know that you guys have had a lot of EVs, which is fantastic.
I love what you're saying right now, because it also means that when we do get in a combustion car, it either feels really bad or really good if it is. Like, there's so many good EVs on sale now that it makes a brand new combustion car kind of have to work harder to garner praise and attention. And that's a good thing.
It's a great point, right? Like, and the fact is, and again, not to harp on, you guys will hear a lot more about Star Awards later in the year, but like the idea of having to really work in the marketplace and not just like an electric vehicle only competes against other electric vehicles, and the same with gas engine cars. All these things are competing for your dollars, right? All of the listeners, like that, all of these cars are marketed at kind of all of you, right? And that's actually why I like this Polestar. So the car that really, really impressed me this year, I've been in a lot of stuff that's awesome for sure. But there's something about the Polestar 2 with a single motor that, you know, it's not the best at anything. Like, it is, as Brett sort of pointed out, it is the most inexpensive car that all of us are going to talk about today, you know, at least in this conversation. It's still not inexpensive for what it's worth. It's like $47,000 before incentives, so it is far from like a bargain car, but a lot more attainable for a lot more people.
It's like an F-150. It's like an average F-150 price, right?
That's right.
It's like an average car price. Yeah. We were just having these discussions recently. You know, in 2022 so far, we're pushing like $45,000, $46,000 for average transaction price for cars. So it's right in the sweet spot. And then you throw in incentives and suddenly you're a little bit under that. Mm-hmm. Again, I don't mean to make light of, for me, I think for any of us, like saying that we're going to buy a nearly $50,000 car would be a big investment and we'd have to take a lot of time and thought to put that money down on it. Absolutely. So it's a big chunk of cash for sure. That being said, the reason that I was so impressed overall with the, and again, like I'm talking specifically about the single motor long range version of the Polestar 2, which comes with a dual motor version, which I think is more, in a weird way right now, it's more like a lot of other EVs in that it's super quick, more expensive, right? More, it has more capability, has less range, which I think is important, but it's a lot more money too. And the single motor version to me hits a sweet spot of price, capability, kind of day-to-day comfort and just usability that makes me think that this is a car that could really slot into the life of many, many drivers right now seamlessly, right? You've got to put an electric, you've got to put a charger in your house and you've got to do a little bit of sort of reorienting, like how you think about driving certain distances. But again, we're talking about, you know, probably low $40,000, when it's all said and done, 270 miles of range on this car, which is, you know, great, but it's not anywhere close to the best in the segment. I think it's very usable for a lot of people, a really nice size, and kind of like just enough amenities inside the car to make it, something that would be really easy to commute in, take your kids to school in. And drive day in and day out, which is there's something to be said about that for sure. Not for nothing. I also think like, I think there's a little bit of a like dorky vibe to it. I think it looks cool, but it doesn't look sexy. But
I'm glad you said that.
It reminds me a little bit of like, you know, like older generations of super, not, it doesn't look like this, but in terms of like the spirit and the vibe, like it's got kind of, you know, Subaru energy from a few generations ago. Or
are we looking at the same car?
It's got this lifted sedan thing. It's like a legacy Outback a little bit.
Oh my God, this just works. I think it's one of the prettiest cars on sale today.
Oh, really? Interesting. All right.
I don't know about that.
Say more about that, because I always thought it was like, I love the way that it looks, but I don't think it's pretty. It's sort of where I came down on it.
Yeah, I like, that's why I said, you know, I approved when you said, you know, kind of a almost like a little nerdy vibe. It's not unattractive. I'm fine with the way it looks. It doesn't really super stand out to me, but for some reason, ever since this came out, I always got kind of like a, almost like a Saab vibe, not with its design, but just with, I don't know, its character. It's like, it's just a little different for the sake of being a little different. I don't know,
S60 cross country maybe.
I'm glad that they actually built a fastback sedan that has a hatch instead of just mm-hmm. being a stupid little vestigial yeah. trunk, because it like really kind of makes that vehicle not just, you know, interesting to look at, but super practical as well.
Oh yeah. So,
I think
in that respect, it kind of does sacrifice everything on the altar of practicality, like an old Subaru or a Saab might.
I think we're all in agreement that liftbacks are superior to regular trunks in every conceivable way.
Yeah. Preaching to the choir, man. I've held on sure. to mine for many, many years. I know it's called a hatchback. Nowadays, you call it liftback because hatchbacks are dorky, but I hauled a washing machine in the back of my Mazda 6. And I mean, the kind of practicality you can get with that, it's like everybody's making liftbacks now. You could have done it years ago.
So Seth, you are a very tall human being, and the thing that stood out to me when I was driving the Polestar 2 is that even though the ride height is relatively high, you put the seat all the way down and like you drop down and you are like mm-hmm. sitting in the car, and you've got a huge amount of space, like even with that like big transmission tunnel there. And it just feels it. You sit real low in it. It feels really nice. Like the belt line is up by your mm-hmm. your shoulder, and it's kind of sports car-y a little bit. What did you think of that?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think that Polestar has used a lot of their design flexibility to create a great interior environment, right? So spaciousness. You can see it's almost a little bit funny because from the outside, and as I'm looking at these photos, I realize like. It doesn't look like it's going to be particularly airy or light in there, but there's something about the combination of the materials that they use in the car and the light that comes in, probably the roof as well, right? Which really does make you feel like you're in a really open area. And the idea that there's also a ton of headroom, even for tall folks, I think adds to that too. So, yeah, I think overall it's like the space inside is going to be workable for a lot of different people in a lot of different situations. The point about the liftback is great, right? Like it's a little SUV, like kind of like mini SUV, like in that regard. Sorry, Clint.
I'm just going to push back on the space a little bit because the rear seat I think is pretty incredibly compact, especially since you can get the same car in an SUV form in the XC40 Recharge and have a much
better space. Then you're a dork. So this is
XC40 Recharge is great.
I'm just saying,
it's twice as powerful as this.
You're not a fun person if you buy an XC40 over this.
But it's very easy to drive across town in traffic, Clint. Come on, man.
So the thing is, here's the thing. So the XC40 is like $4,000 more before incentives, but it's dual motor. It's basically twice the power. Like Nier's makes no difference. It's a freaking rocket ship.
I really like the Polestar 2. I'm not going to like besmirch it one little bit. The only thing is, it just doesn't have much of a usable back seat for
as
very
nice right
and as comfortable
that.
As the interior is, and as great as the
cargo
area is.
I can't take that away
is,
from you.
Yeah,
just, I do really love the front seats in it. They are great.
It's a very comfortable vehicle for sure. If you're not one of the people in the back, or if you've got small kids like Seth does.
Yeah, I put my kids. Maybe I'm over-indexing a little bit because I put my kids in it and I was able to drive the car without feeling like I was cramped, right? Which is, I probably said it before on this podcast. I've certainly ridden it before. Like my wife has a 2017 Audi Q5, and I can't drive that car with the car seat behind it and not feel cramped. So as a cop, absolutely. I just did. Last weekend across the state, and it's like I'm eating my knees the entire time. So I would say that is also a very specific metric, right? Because it's like the car seat that I have, which is rear facing and like my particular body, but it did fit in a way that felt like I wasn't either compressing the car seat, which you don't want to do, or pushing my knees up into the dash. So
it might be like a legroom versus headroom thing, because my brother has a G35 coupe and a Volvo XC90. And he fits better with car seats behind him in the G35 than he does in the XC90 because it's a longer rear seat that has a lot less vertical space. So it could just be a case of that, but you know, I can't get comfortable in the Polestar 2 because my head's on the headliner, but your family fits great in it because it has the length that you need for those rear facing seats.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Overall, I was just really impressed with it as a thing that you could drive day to day. And we tend to not talk about like brand new EVs, especially from, you know, I know Polestar is obviously like got the Volvo relationship. So it sort of splits the difference between legacy and brand new, but it has less of the sort of sex appeal, like headline appeal of some of, again, like the Lucids and the Rivians and the Teslas, right? But I think it's something that people would be really happy with day-to-day. Other than I'm looking at that now, the very hard to access and small frunk pisses me off a little bit for an EV. Fair.
Does it use the Google operating system for the infotainment as well?
Yes.
How is it? Does it work?
Now it has CarPlay too.
Yeah.
Few weeks.
I didn't love it. I wasn't like diving deep in it. I probably should have been playing around with it a little bit more. But yeah, it wasn't my favorite immediately for sure. I thought the graphics were nice. The screen was nice. Resolution and processing power and all that seemed to be okay. But it didn't feel like.
It put things in weird order in that menu, but it has native Spotify integration. So you can sign in. You sign into your Google account and everything's there. Really good navigation once you're in there. They just lay it out in a way that doesn't make any sense. But once you're in there, everything is awesome.
Cool. So, Clint, I know you have a hard out coming up, and we are not quite done with the show. So how about this? Everyone gets 4 minutes. I'm going to be watching the time. You get 4 minutes to talk about the other cars that you provided us with. And, Clint, we will start with you just so, you know, if you got to go, you got to go. And we will go from there. Does that sound fair to everyone?
It makes me feel so important.
Sure.
I have a hard out. I have places to be everywhere.
You do have places to be, don't you?
Nowhere am I lying? Be, all right. Hey.
The rest of us have no life, but you are the rock star.
Exactly.
All right. 4 minutes, easy. This is no problem for me. My second car that I chose was the... I hope you have a buzzer too. Is the Acura NSX Type S, a vehicle? The NSX.
Oh, I'm sorry, you're out of time, Clint. No. It's a cool car. Go ahead.
The NSX, since it came out years ago, I have been in love with. I have raved about that car through a few different reviews, and then they debuted this one, and I thought to myself, crap, that's what it should have been the entire time. And I think Acura knew that too. They made it look better. They learned over 5 or 6 years of development and snuck in these really thoughtful improvements into this car from the regular NSX. Mm-hmm. And the fact that they've limited the production, like I was actually on this podcast talking to the Chris's mm-hmm. about sure this car, and I was just geeked out about it. I thought that they're writing it off. You know, they're ending the production in a way that's like respectful to the car, celebrating it. And I think real Acura enthusiasts, Honda enthusiasts will love this thing forever because of it. I mean, the regular NSX was always liked, but maybe never loved across the board like a Porsche product. And this sure. just kind of like kicked up the excitement and the celebration for me in a way that felt really special.
Very cool.
So, I mean, you've got
3 minutes, by the way.
Yeah.
What else do you want to talk about? It looks really good in gray. It looks less good in yellow. But the time that I spent with it was in South Florida, which is the caveat in saying we were on only a few roads that turned left or right. and it was 1.5 million degrees outside. And even so, like, it still felt like the coolest thing ever. It was cool enough to excuse the fact that the infotainment is from like decades ago. Like, it's horrible to interact with. The practicality stuff isn't there, but everything about it was just so cool. And it felt like genuine improvements over the regular NSX too. It felt more with it. And when you ask like Acura what they did to make the electric motors better, to the tweaks of the engine, like, all of the things were done very particularly, and they learned from the regular NSX in order to make them.
Well, and that was going to be my question that you just kind of answered. Is the Type S really that big of a difference, or really that big of a step versus the standard NSX?
For sure. Like, if future Brett bought a regular NSX, I would go find a Type S, buy it, park it in his driveway, and just remind him of the mistake that he made. Because this, over time, the legacy with the Type S, it's just going to go down as so much more of a special car. I really do believe
that. Did I punch your mother or something, Clint, and not remember it? I'm so confused.
I think it's because you never said thank you for me delivering that Boxster for you. That was a long way across town, all right?
I just think that you got to remember, right? Like, Honda doesn't do things, and sorry, I'm doing the thing that I always yell at people about, lumping them together. But Honda, Acura, they don't do things like other automakers. We're not talking about talking about Stellantis here. We're not talking about like 10% jumps in horsepower from one model to the next. Like, the Type S NSX was always meant to be a car that was basically better around a racetrack, right? And I think that everything that they've done has made it better around a racetrack. It's subtle. You have to really like care about the model to understand it. And it's not realized in horsepower figures, but that's okay because it's not a horsepower car to begin with. If you wanted horsepower, you'd be in something completely different. So I think it's a...
Sorry to... Like, end my little thing here. The NSX Type S did something immediately that the regular NSX could never do. Sell out.
Ouch.
Okay. Well, ouch. Clint, you have 1 minute left, so I'm going to finish out your 1 minute and say thank you very much for being on this show. This will be Clint's last appearance on this show as a person with Motor One. That's all I'm going to say. But he has been fantastic as... Smith, you might remember that in the very early episodes, the two episodes that never came out, Clint was our guest on those, helping us out. So
when we were doing the tests.
There would be no rambling about cars without a Clint Simone. So
Clint Simone was an original co-host on the never aired pilot. So Clint, we're going to miss having you on every
episode.
But
we had to prove that we could do this, and you were incredibly helpful, and you've always been incredibly helpful. So thank you for being with us, and you will always be with us. And if you ever want to come back and talk about something, you are welcome to come back. And if you need to go play tennis now, then you go ahead and leave. And if not, you stay with us.
Well, I have to stay so I can yell at people as they say things. But thank you very much. You know I appreciate that. And you know I will continue to watch and listen and leave comments for you to hit back with in the future.
Rambling about cars. Clint Simone, legendary. We are going to start the GoFundMe account so you can build up that left ankle so you don't have such a problem with your manual transmissions. We want to help you out, buddy. We're there for you. Brandon, let's jump over to you. Can we jump over to you next, man?
Sure. I mean, after that send off, though, I don't know.
Well, you're so not. Are you going anywhere?
I'd like to.
ooh, that's dark.
Oh, wow.
Wow. You'd be like the kitchen after the podcast, right?
Yes, that is exactly what I mean.
Give me the buzzer. I'll keep them honest.
No, so it's funny that you know Seth is talking about how Honda built the how Acura built the NSX Type S to simply be better to go around a racetrack, because the car that I'm going to talk about, which you could actually buy this time at some point in the distant future.
Eventually,
was built to not be so good around a racetrack. And it is the BMW XM. This was a prototype that I drove in also in Germany, or well, Austria, back in, I want to say May. And it is only the second car developed solely for BMW M, along with the M1. It will not have a regular BMW equivalent. And what really struck me about this is that even though it is like the first electrified M car, like it is a plug-in hybrid, it has a bunch of firsts. It's a first with active anti-roll bars and rear wheel steering and like these great technologies. It feels like a BMW M car from 20 years ago. It's not solely focused on going fast and turning a quick lap. It's not super firm and uncomfortable. I've been fortunate enough, along with Brett, I'm pretty sure you and Clint for sure, to have driven most of the BMW M catalog right now. And I think we're all pretty much in agreement that they're brilliant cars if your daily commute is a racetrack every day. But if you have to drive them anywhere that's ever seen a pothole, it's a miserable, miserable experience.
Totally agree.
And the XM is going to kind of flip the script on that. Like, this is going to be the everyday driver's M car. It blew me away with how composed and how entertaining and how engaging it was for like a big heavy SUV.
I'm just very perturbed by the fact that you're comparing this to the M cars of 20 years ago, which was the E46 M3 and the E39 M5. So
I'm glad somebody else.
So 15 years ago, it really reminded like it. My favorite M car is the E92 M3, and I know the E46 people will freak out about that. It was the most enjoyable M car I've driven since then. I mean, the steering is just absolute precision. The powertrain is beautifully integrated between gas and electric. It is hugely powerful. I cannot wait to drive the production version of it. It left such an impression. There are some weird things about it. I'm really, really confused about why BMW M is just dangling its toe in the water instead of like going all in on electrification. Launching a PHEV in, I think we'll see this in later this year, if not early next year. Launching a PHEV is a little bit of an odd move, especially considering, and Clint, I know you feel the same way, how good the iX is. So that part is a little bit weird.
AMG's doing it, so I feel like they want to say we can do it too. And it's a performance focused plug-in. The only point I was going to make about the iX, I'm happy you said that, a car that you and I both love. This is going to be the same situation where it's going to be the business and you're going to have to make excuses for the way it looks.
Yes. Yes. That's the thing. BMW is building the best cars to drive that you never want to be seen in.
Oh my god, it's so absolutely true.
Like I know, like there is not a single car on the planet that doesn't come with some kind of drawbacks. It's just BMW's drawbacks is how it looks, and that's looking really right problematic. Like that's the thing. I would rather drive a car that breaks down constantly but looks beautiful, like an Aston Martin, and have that. Whereas have something that everyone's gonna be like, why would he buy that? And then you have to explain, well, oh, actually the steering is very good and it's very quick and it sounds nice. And it's just,
I mean, you could also
all of these little, like, you just have to call yourself out as a giant freaking nerd.
It's true.
All right. Who's next? Brett, you want to go next? We got to keep things going. Very astute observations, Brandon. Let's see what Brett has to say here.
We're talking about the best cars that we've driven so far this year, and it was really, really hard to overlook the most expensive car I have ever driven and probably will ever drive. It's the McLaren 765 LT Spider. This was another one of those cars that pretty much from the moment they dropped it off to the moment they picked it up, I just was sitting behind the wheel, either looking at it and pretending to drive it or actually going out on the road. I took my neighbor's kid out for a ride in this car, and the entire time he had his hands out the Targa roof, just like laughing his head off. He asked for a picture because he knew his friends wouldn't believe him when he said that he rode around in a McLaren. This is just the kind of vehicle that like brought immense joy the entire time I had it. And there's no question as to why, because it costs more than $500,000. But it was just, again, it was just one of those really fun, rare experiences that I couldn't say no to. I wanted to democratize this conversation a little bit, but I couldn't honestly look myself in the mirror and say, yeah, that $500,000 car I drove earlier this year was just okay. Like, no, this is the best car I will ever drive in my life.
The thing about them, I haven't driven the 765 LT. I've driven the 720S and the 720S Spider. And the thing that always gets me about them is it's very easy to forget that you're driving something that is that powerful and is that capable. It's such an easy vehicle to drive. And is it any different with the LT?
I don't know. It must be because I was terrified the whole time. But yeah,
What's that? Anybody who has been in a McLaren and thought to themselves, like, this could go a little faster. They should give it some more stuff. Like, it yeah. blows my mind. I know money is the answer, that they can go further. So they did, and people will buy it either way. But the 720S was a car that legitimately terrified me, and I haven't driven this one.
Yeah, no, it was a lot for sure. The first day, I just sat in it and looked at it the first day because I was honestly kind of nervous to drive it. It took a solid night of sleep to build up the courage. But you know, to that end, I will say it actually wasn't as fast as it looked. Like, it looks crazy fast, but when you actually look at the acceleration and top speed numbers, it's not appreciably quicker than like a 911 GTS, for example, which is a much more approachable vehicle, you know, just in general. But this still just felt...
I'm struggling with that one.
Same.
This is the only car I've been going 90 miles an hour on. It's the only car I've been going 90 miles an hour in, and I put my foot on the throttle to accelerate, and I feel all of the weight transfer backwards. Like, you don't feel that level of acceleration.
Yeah.
From 90 miles an hour. It's hilariously fast.
It's freaking.
I'm not going to disagree with that. Like, it is a super fast vehicle, but a lot of the intimidation factor went away when I got home and I looked at like the spec chart and just was like, oh, it's fast, but it's not a whole lot faster than the Boxster or the 911 GTS I was just in a couple of days ago. You know, like, it's super fast, but a lot of the intimidation factor went away. The thing that's most impressive about it, though, is just like, it just feels special and exotic. You're not insulated from any of the noises that it makes. Like, it creaks around like crazy. It's not delicate. It's not refined. It's very raw, which is really cool. But you know, there's still a whole lot of intimidation factor and a whole lot of speed going on.
I also just think like this is, I think all McLarens, like all modern McLarens, like have had a little bit of an Achilles heel from a design perspective. Like, they're all beautiful from a lot of angles and then really weird looking from some angles. you know, and a little bit strange. This car, I think, comes together in a way that maybe hasn't happened in since McLaren has relaunched sort of its line of road cars. So I think it looks great. In a weird way, to me, it's almost, and I know this is dating myself a bit, but it's sort of like the anti Senna a little bit. Like, the Senna was so ugly, but insanely fast, like faster than your brain could comprehend. And so maybe this one almost looks a little faster than it is, although maybe you guys would disagree on that. I have yet to drive it.
I think you're spot on there, Seth. I think that's a very astute assessment. And you know what? It's so good. Why don't you take us home here for the last segment?
Yes. So obviously we're all going as has been pointed out. Like, we've left the blue collar cars behind entirely. So the one of the coolest cars that I drove this year, and I think. I don't know whether or not it right where it ranks on the importance scale. Certainly it would be a great, it would, it would, make a strong argument for itself for one of the best SUVs of this year is the Aston Martin DBX 707. Again, very practically unattainable. We're talking about $250,000 basically for a nearly 700 horsepower SUV that does 0 to 60 in about 3 seconds. You know, it doesn't hurt that I only drove this car once, but it was on an island off the coast of Italy that made it really good. But
that's gonna help.
No, this thing, the DBX in and of itself is a fun to drive high performance SUV with an Aston badge on it, and I think it carries a lot of cachet and people care about it. But it never really felt like to be blunt. Though it was great to drive, it was one of those Astons that I've driven in my career that was a little bit disappointing because it didn't have quite the speed. It handled very well, but it didn't have that emotional kind of appeal when you're driving it to back up what people expect from the Aston Martin badge. And I think everything that was lacking in the standard DBX is made up for in the 707. The extra power, it's stiffer. Handles incredibly well. It absolutely feels like a sports car. So there's none of that, like, you know, it's great for an SUV. It's just great full stop in terms of handling on some really amazing roads. The acceleration is otherworldly. The noises it makes are completely bananas. I just it's hard to think of a fault in its game. Again, as long as you're in the market for something that costs $250,000, right? It is pretty dynamically perfect. You can quibble a little bit about like whether or not you would want to live with some of the interior stuff, the technology, like day to day, but you know, who effing cares, right? At this point, when it's a car that's this much fun. So I really appreciated it. I think that it looks fantastic. And even in this like new genre of sort of super SUVs that I'm sure the guys in LA see all the time. And a lot of us are seeing more and more in urban areas. I do think that this stands out and there's probably an element of one-upsmanship too for owning one of these as opposed to owning, you know, last year's Urus or something like that. So
I think that's the DBX's like most significant like advantage factor is even in LA, you don't see a ton of them. You see way more Cullinans, way more Lamborghinis, way more. Like Bentaygas. By a wide margin than the 707, than the DBX. So if you really want to stand out, this is kind of a cool oddball choice that has a little more cachet than, you know, a valet Volkswagen.
I haven't driven the 707. I did drive the standard one. I shared it with Seth. The thing that I struggled with is that I could never really escape the Mercedes-ness of it. Because it's a Mercedes engine and Mercedes infotainment system. And I did the mechanical changes kind of hide that a little bit, or did they exacerbate it, or what?
I think that it's a great point. And I don't think, like, if you know, like we do, if you're testing a bunch of cars, like you're never going to, it's the fact that you're pulling
from. It's totally an inside baseball thing.
Yeah. But I would also say, like, just even inside baseball, like, what a great parts bin to pull from, right? If you're pulling from the Mercedes one. Yeah, I don't know. Like, I would probably have to have better, like, overall total market context of stuff that I've driven, Brandon. Like, you've driven more stuff than me to be able to tell you whether or not the driving experience kind of, like rose above some of the Mercedes stuff. I would say that, like, from what I could see and feel, it was still there, but the driving experience absolutely felt elevated. I mean, obviously, this has the same... You're going to have to remind me what it comes out of, but the same like twin turbocharged
It's a 4 liter V8 from like GLE and GLS.
Yeah.
And
all the engine is the perfect parts bin thing. Command infotainment is two generations back now, which is tragic.
Right. It didn't sound like any Mercedes that I've driven for sure. Like the exhaust, obviously Aston does a lot of tuning of everything that they get from Mercedes to make it feel sort of appropriate for the brand. But the car just rips. It sounds amazing. Even at an idle, like a revving at idle, it sounds really good. And certainly at, you know, kind of like 4,000, 5,000 RPMs, it sounds absolutely insane. So, I think that it works. I think they've done an incredible job with the pieces that they had to pull together to make it both feel special and appropriate for Aston. So I dig it. I think it's a pretty special thing again in this rarefied world of high dollar SUVs.
Well, and we know that there's a market for it. And I think Lamborghini especially has shown there's a market for these higher end SUVs. Gentlemen, thank you all very much for your input, for your picks here. Ramblers listening out there, what are the best cars you've driven so far in 2022? You know what to do. Email us, for crying out loud, podcast@motorone.com. You can always go to our YouTube page, Motor One Podcast. By the way, like, follow, and subscribe. Probably should have said that at the beginning. Sorry, Clint. You've been harping on that with us ever since the beginning. Now you're going away, so you're going to have to email us or put in the comments. Like, that's follow, subscribe. Leaving, this is true.
You're driving him away.
I've busted on him too much with that and the pop culture stuff. But hey, email us. You know what to do. We appreciate you guys taking some time out here to listen. We appreciate our guests, Clint Simone, Brett Evans, Brandon Turkus, Seth Miersma. Is there anything you guys want to plug? Oh, there is one thing that I want to plug for you. If you enjoyed listening to these guys talk today, you need to check out every Friday, 4 p.m. Eastern time, the Motor One Happy Hour, because we do it live. Seth is there talking with generally two or three of the editors, just talking about what they're driving that week. Every Friday, 4 p.m., you can catch it on Motor One socials. We'll put an article up on the website. You can catch it there. You definitely want to do that. Anything else you guys want to plug here before we head out for the day?
I think we're good.
Yeah.
That was neat and tidy. That was the best one you've ever done.
Yeah,
you absolutely. Go to motorone.com, read all the stories, click all the buttons, follow us on social. We would love to have you. We've got literally dozens of new stories almost every day, reviews, mm-hmm. videos, all the good stuff. So definitely check us out there if you haven't yet already. Mm-hmm.
Well, Smith, you did all of my jobs for me.
I didn't do all of your jobs. You did. You got the classic Bruce outro, man.
I know. So
everybody's waiting for it.
Well, here it comes. Good afternoon, good evening, or good night. We appreciate every listener. We appreciate every comment. We appreciate every click, every listen, every whatever you can do for this show. And we love you all. So thank you for all of that. Thank you for all of our guests tonight. Again, Clint Simone, Brett T. Evans, Brandon Turkus, Seth Miersma. Thank you so much for giving us your time. And thank you for giving us your time and listening to the show. And with that, we are going to be out this week, and we will talk to you again and be rambling next week. So bye-bye.
See ya.